You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we only use reaction gifts of the White Power Ranger. I'm your host, Justin Ebleszneski, and if you enjoy your trip into the midside here today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism, or you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/themidside, or themidside.com/Patreon. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
And what a glorious trip it will be. I've booked my first class ticket. And I'm awaiting that free champagne, that sweet, sweet free champagne that I paid $4,000 for.
Well, I am straight edge, so on my flights, there is no alcohol.
Fuck it. Refund. Where's my parachute?
Parachute's coming soon with the False Dichotomy Bro t-shirts. Look for those in the next couple of weeks. We're working on the goddamn design. I don't work quickly here, people. Jesus. Also joining us this trip, from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
I'm super psyched to be here today. We took that, me and Justin took that Adam Carolla podcast masterclass yesterday. It was 6 hours of advice. A lot of it was kind of common sense, but you know, you read into it, you really listen to a lot of that implicit experience Adam Carolla has from all these years of, you know, talking into a mic for 3 hours at a time, and it's just a lot of good energy, and the whole time I just wanted to get in front of a microphone and talk, so now I get to, so yeah.
You two took a masterclass on podcasting, it really shows. It's just, it's like I stepped into the room with the veteran radio voices today. It's really
Daniel
embarrassing.
Is,
right?
Of course,
it's embarrassing on my part, really.
He's, of course, referring to the fact that both of our audio settings fucked up this morning after we went to the masterclass yesterday. So,
good I also want to job, know, was the masterclass basically 6 hours of Adam Carolla screaming at you just to say yes and?
Pretty much. There's actually this. You'll appreciate this part that happened. At one point, Gina Grad and Ball Bryan came on stage. I messed up my S words. First rule podcasting, don't confuse your words. They came on stage to share tips of what they've learned out of how to be better podcasters. And Gina did like her whole list. She had a PowerPoint behind her, and every time she said one of them, it popped up behind her. And right before she did the last one, Adam interrupted her. And he was like, hold on, can I just add something to what you're saying? And he went into his whole part of being a good podcaster and a good yes-ander is listening. And nobody listens. And then after like his 15-minute rant on the importance of listening, Gina just put up her next point, and the last one was listen. And he was like, you actually listen to me? And she's like, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What were you saying about the fashion show?
I was saying that I am going to actually listen to you, unlike you apparently not listening to me. And I'm going to do that as you lead us into the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
What would the week be without a story about Donald Trump? I think we should have a Trump count in terms of how many stories we've done on the President of the United States.
Well, Donald we've had Trump, 28 episodes this season, so at least 28.
The commander-in-chief of the world's most powerful military. I like to remind everyone of that. Trump and GOP senators unveiled a new immigration bill this week that would cut legal immigration in half, but change it to a merit-based system instead of the mostly relative-based system that we have now. Trump said, as a candidate, I campaigned on creating a merit-based immigration system that protects U.S. workers and taxpayers, and that's why we are here today. He added that the measure would, quote, reduce poverty, increase wages, and save taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. billions and billions this immigration bill would save. Just curious how that comes about. But Trump met with Senators Cotton and Perdue to discuss this legislation known as the Reforming American Immigration for a Strong Economy Act, or the RAISE Act. The bill would mark a dramatic change in U.S. immigration laws and could open up a nasty internal fight among Republicans, half of whom are Democrats. So, Justin, what say you about Trump's immigration law? It seems as if there are some maybe interestingly good things and some characteristically terrible things.
Well, I just don't understand any of it at all. I mean, isn't the problem illegal immigration? The problem is not legal immigration, right? This is like players are cheating and you enforce things on the people who aren't cheating. Like, I don't understand what's going on. And my other question about this is, because it's very vague, what is the merit? Like, how do you get in? Do you just, like, pledge your undying allegiance to Trump? Is that how you get in?
I'm sure that would definitely work.
Question number one, is Donald Trump a great president or the greatest president?
And if you say great, you don't get in.
Yes. It's unclear.
Say great, he just says wrong.
And he says you're fired.
What the merit is, but that is actually an interesting question, one brought up by Midsider Elliot on Facebook this week, where he asks, merit according to whom? Who gets to decide what your merit is? Is this a government thing? Is it an employer thing? Who gets to decide by what merit you get into the country? Is there a problem with that?
I was assuming that the standard would be set in the bill, or is that too rational? Is that just my rationality kicking in that even they're not even that rational, that it's just going to be completely randomness?
Oh, Justin.
I mean, they're not going to do that.
I think it's adorable that you think that bills actually lead to rational law. What the bill will do and what every bill has done in the past decade is basically say, or maybe longer than a decade, we have this thing we want to accomplish, which is to let immigrants in based on merit. Now you, unelected bureaucrats, decide what that means. And this way, the senators and the representatives who pass this law can say, hey, all we wanted to do is pass immigration reform, and these completely unelected bureaucrats fucked up what we wanted, you know, so you should reelect me so we can be down with these bureaucrats who I empowered to do this thing in the first place.
Oh, my God.
Right. Even though I am the ultimate bureaucrat, I am blaming these lesser bureaucrats in order to get myself more power. It's sick.
Yeah, it's a fucking shell game of terrible.
Yeah.
It's a shell game where no matter what shell you pick up, you get shit.
My initial reaction to the shit is that having the government define merit is fucking dangerous and fucking evil. You know, they shouldn't be defining morality. They shouldn't be defining who's good and who's bad. That's for every individual to decide. But the other hand to that is, isn't there a legitimate role of government to protect the people? And isn't part of that who you let into the country? And, you know, just to use, you know, the argument from extremes where you pick an extreme and you say, well, doesn't this show we want something of this? We wouldn't want the government to let serial killers into the country. Correct? Yes.
Correct.
So then there is some sort of merit-based standard to immigration.
Yeah, I don't think merit-based is inherently problematic depending on sort of how broadly you define merit-based. And this gets into a point where it's like, well, I would be wanting to let more people in the country as long as they were people who had employment histories or advanced degrees or high IQs or who were tremendous athletes or basically anyone
or huge dongs.
Huge dongs. That's right. Although there was
gotta have those immigrants coming in to satisfy our women.
That's right. Doing jobs Americans haven't done for hundreds of years. But
well, I mean, isn't that why we took them over in the slave ships back in the day?
Yes. Oh, thank you, Justin. It's what the show needed. Was
Justin gets his
slavery reference.
His statement in for the week.
Okay. How do we bounce back from that? James, what is your take on a merit-based immigration system? Immigration overall is just this enormously weird, complicated, convoluted political football that no one actually wants to do anything about. But what is what do you think about the concept of a merit-based system in general?
I don't like the concept of a merit-based system, or at least a directly merit-based one. I think the left transparently the left transparent it is completely transparent that this is a vote buying slash support buying scheme for them. And it's because of the following. The Republicans have this completely legitimate gripe about, okay, they're going to come over here and they're going to be using our schools and using our welfare and not putting in tax money in response, and not be putting in tax money. And whether that pans out statistically, that is a valid concern. Like, because we don't know necessarily what it will look like statistically once they come over. So to me, the solution is really simple. Let as many in as you want, but don't let them vote and don't let them have any government services, including welfare or education. And they would be a huge boon to our economy. Not only that, but after 100 years, they would become the wealthiest class in our economy if you didn't let them go to government schools and you didn't give them welfare. So the fact that they would come over here just to be in America and work, that's all the merit selection you'll need. And of course, don't let in the murderers and rapists, you know. But other than that, you know, let them in.
Yeah.
Interesting proposal. And I agree with what you're saying, that the people who would work hard are the people who would come over here because they would be looking for work. But my question is, would any of them actually come over if they were denied government services? Isn't part of the reason people are coming is because they just automatically get this free shit when they go into America? I mean, it's America is the Black Friday of countries right now, isn't it? Like, we have all these doorbusters to get these immigrants to show up, and then, like, all they do is fight each other the whole time.
Yes, everyone here gets a free toaster upon entry. It's a good immigration policy. I agree with James. I don't think this kind of proposal is thought about enough. And to Justin's point, maybe even if immigration reduces 50% if we eliminate this program, so what? The sort of question is like, well, aren't we going to get better immigrants then? And I think that's a net positive for everyone. But I don't know why, James, this is not brought up more to basically distinguish between residency and citizenship. Like, and it's sort of, to me, on a more philosophical note, it's sort of like the difference between a natural right and a civil right, where we don't really have a right to stop people from moving where they want to move, but there is a certain element in which government has a say in who is a citizen of a given area. And maybe it's we allow immigration, you know, as much immigration as we want for people who want to be residents, but then they have to go through a process to become a citizen in order to have access to all these various government nonsense things anyway.
It's like the difference between a mistress and a wife. We're okay if you want to come over here and just be a mistress. We don't want to give you the legal benefits of a wife. You don't deserve it. You don't have the merit.
When you leave, you don't get to take half of our shit.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And the kid is ours. We get to keep the kid.
I don't know if that's the best analogy. I mean, yes, and that's a bad analogy. But I don't think it's a philosophical thing that stops us from enacting that mindset. I think the Democrats and like the Republicans will not go there, even though I think they would, some of them would want to. The Republicans will not go there because they will just simply be called racists by the Democrats. The Democrats will go insane if any Republican proposed what I just said, like, oh, they don't get welfare. It's like, but they're you're a racist.
At what point is that going to stop working?
Never.
Never.
Because, because at the end of the day, the moral system of the culture is on the side of the Democrats. Like, why should we not be sacrificing to these people?
But
like, why should we not be sacrificing to everyone continuously?
To push back a tiny bit, James, or maybe a lot bit, don't we have a president who was just elected, even though literally 50% of the country was screaming racist at him?
Yeah. So it's not.
Yeah, we might see pushback. Yeah,
I agree with what James is saying, that the moral foundation is skewed against the right. But I think Daniel raises a very important point that, you know, half the country doesn't buy into that anymore. And ultimately what it comes down to, James, to add on to what you're saying and build on it, is it comes down to self-esteem, where people wouldn't buy into this, oh my God, people think I'm racist crap, if they weren't second-handed, if they actually had self-esteem and were confident in their own beliefs. Because a lot of it is you say something that, you know, people construe a certain way, and if you don't have the self-esteem and you care about what other people think too much, you then doubt your own beliefs. Otherwise, you're secure in them because you know, no, I'm not racist. I'm not sexist. I'm just being realistic.
Yeah.
It's as if, I mean, the altruist code ultimately makes self-esteem impossible.
It's as if consistently all of this is connected in some weird philosophical way.
Yeah. Right.
Completely changing gears from Trump to Netflix.
Completely changing gears?
Next on entertainment.
I mean, isn't Trump kind of like the Netflix of presidents where he's like, okay, everyone...
He's like the TMZ of presidents.
Yeah, but that's what Netflix is too, because they're like, everyone wants to see Adam Sandler in a Western, so let's have Adam Sandler produce a Western very quickly. Isn't that how Donald Trump became president? They're like, we'd like to see a celebrity and an obnoxious white guy as president. Oh, here's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly. We're going to find out later that this was all a Netflix reality show. That's really what it is. But can Netflix keep spending its way to success is the question the Los Angeles Times asks, pointing out that Netflix is on the hook for $20 billion. That is, they are $20 billion in debt. So the article goes through a history of Netflix, basically explaining how it transformed the entertainment industry, puts out some very interesting facts. For instance, they have 104 million subscribers worldwide. That's up 25% from last year alone. Its series and movies account for, are you ready for this? A third of all primetime download internet traffic in North America.
Damn.
That's incredible. And its shows, its 50 original shows garnered 91 Emmy nominations this year, second only to HBO. But here's the problem. In order for Netflix to get where they are today, they've had to spend an incredible amount of money very quickly, mostly in producing original content. They've spent, in fact, they're in debt, $20.54 billion in long-term obligations. So Netflix is burning through cash at an unprecedented rate, and the question is, how can it sustain this? How can it sustain burning through this amount of money if they're not making this amount of money back in the long term? Mike Vorhaus, president of Majid Advisor, says, nobody is ever the dominant player forever. I think they're going to need some luck in not drowning in debt and the ultimate slowdown of growth. Justin, one, is Netflix going to be around in 10 years? And two, why do you think that the growth rate of Netflix hasn't necessarily turned into profits?
First of all, I'm going to answer those questions, but I have to ask you, did you accidentally say Netflix?
Maybe I did. That is a completely different platform.
Yeah, I think YouPorn has a new new competitor here.
That's when the new sex bots come out. Yeah.
So the first thing about this article is it's deceptive. Because the $20 billion is not right now. It's over the next few years. It's what they've committed to original programming projecting out over the next few years. So that's sort of deceptive because you have to look at your intake and your outtake based upon the year. So they don't really ever go into what Netflix is actually doing each year based upon what they're spending. So I don't know about that. But the second thing is, we talked about on the show and off the show that Amazon has still yet to turn a profit, correct?
Amazon has now turned a profit, but it took a very, very, very long time.
Okay, and now Bezos is the most, he's the richest man in the world?
Yes.
All right, so I'm not going to fucking criticize them for this. Clearly they know something, and it worked for Amazon. Everyone's like, oh, Amazon's never made money. They've never made a profit. They just give away shit, free shipping and blah, blah, blah. Now the dude owns Whole Foods, right? And now he owns the Washington Post.
The ultimate mark of success, owning Whole Foods.
No, I'm just saying he owns like a newspaper, a grocery store chain, the world's
largest.
You
thought shopping there was expensive. Yeah.
Online retailer, like, so the model works somehow. And then the other thing I want to say is, you said they have 105 subscribers.
I did.
Worldwide. Yes, worldwide.
105?
Million. Million.
My YouTube channel gets more than that.
Million.
Yeah, it's something like that. Let me find the exact point in the story. But it's okay. 104 million, up 25% from last year alone.
Okay, so I don't know how many are adults, but there are 7 billion people on the planet. And if they're looking at their marketplace as global and not the United States, they still have a hell of a lot upwards to go. Now, there is without a doubt that there is a finite number of people, and there is a finite number of people who are interested in binge-watching shows on the internet. But I don't think they've reached anywhere close to that. And I would venture, as I said, I'm not a business person, but I would venture they're smart enough to look and project outwards and say, oh, if we keep spending this way for 5 years, it's not going to kill us. It's just going to keep growing our business. And then at a certain point, we'll just start reining back on what we're spending. Because their ultimate goal, I think, is to have, what does it say, 50% original programming?
Yes. Well, that's the real question, right?
I just think they know what they're doing, is what I'm saying.
Is the original programming model, do you think that that's a recipe for long-term success? I mean, the original programming we've seen is sort of really mixed bag.
Mixed bag quality-wise?
Yeah. We're the number one critics of Netflix, maybe on the internet. I want to point that out. Every fucking episode, we have a critique of Netflix's terrible content.
But, I mean, how is that any different from network TV and all the terrible content they've had over the years?
They can sell advertising. That's the difference.
Yeah. I mean, all they're doing is they're making a bet. And, James, maybe you can springboard off of this because it sounded like you had something to say. But all they're doing is making the bet on the death of network television, and they're trying to set themselves up as the replacement. Eventually, everything's going to move to streaming and the internet, and they just want to be that number one replacement when that happens.
Yeah.
I think they've already achieved that as far as branding. Like, when someone, like, if you asked someone, like, oh, hey, I'm going to watch Game of Thrones, and they're like, oh, how do you watch that online? Oh, you go to HBO Go. It's like Netflix, but you can watch HBO shows. You know, that's the way people are going to think about it. Like, Netflix has the branding. What I don't think they have a lot of original programming, which is good, but I don't see people pining away for their original programming. They have a lot of bad original programming, but they have a lot of solid original programming too. Like, you can go there and find some, you know, Marco Polo, House of Cards. Like, these are some solid things. Like, you will be entertained. But what they don't have is the sort of show that gets you, like, a subscription. That I'm convinced that HBO Go gets huge numbers of subscribers just because that's how you can get Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
On a show like that, but I don't think Netflix has something like that.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure.
They certainly don't.
Certainly, they have core shows that have brought people in to some degree, like Stranger Things, House of Cards, that season of Arrested Development, even though it blew goats.
All the Marvel series.
The Marvel series, perhaps. But to sort of emphasize a point that James maybe de-emphasized a little bit, have you ever clicked the tab Netflix Originals and scrolled through it? There's an incredible amount of Netflix Originals, most of which are complete schlock.
But you only need a few good ones to attract people. Like, I'm not going to delete my Netflix account because the majority of it is schlock. Like, I'm not going to delete my internet connection because the majority of the internet is something I don't want to look at. You know, just has to have a certain amount I do want to look at.
Right, that's 100% correct. But the issue is investment versus return. And if they're basically using the splatter approach where they're throwing billions of dollars and hoping they get a hit like Stranger Things, but 19 of the $1 billion is crap, they're not really spending their money wisely. And the point is that going to last in the long run?
I don't know. It's an interesting model. I'm definitely not some business powerhouse here saying I know better than these geniuses in the market. I just...
Yeah, right.
I'm certainly... I'm taken aback by the whole thing, really. I had no idea that see what I did there? What Netflix was doing was similar to the Amazon approach. I just think that the Amazon approach made a lot more sort of immediately logical sense. Basically, yeah. We will build up this platform of subscribers who want these things, and then eventually we will make money. Amazon's not selling their own products, though, right? It's not like we're getting Amazon fucking hand soap or peanut butter or whatever it is when we're ordering things. Like, two things I just ordered, which is why they were at the top of my head.
Okay.
But
I always use the Jeff Bezos exclusive Amazon condom. So they actually have like an impression of Jeff Bezos's face, like, on the head.
He does.
It's kind of weird.
I mean,
especially...
If you're going to say which CEO looks the most like a penis, he's at least top five.
Oh, I see. I pictured him like facing your... I pictured him like facing you.
Like looking up at you.
Yeah. Yeah, no two-day delivery for you.
I apologize to the listeners.
Well, it would take two-day delivery if you got to look at Jeff Bezos the whole time.
That's right. So, moving on to the next story for which there is no good transition, because this might as well be named the incongruent edition of the midsize.
Wait, no, this predator, we're talking about taking 2 days because you're looking at an unattractive man while having sex. There's your transition, sir.
Terrible. That was fucking terrible. Maxim reports on a study. Yes, we're getting our news from Maxim now. Women are happier when their partner is less attractive than they are, says a new study. And of course, it must be true because a study said it.
Yeah.
This article begins, "We've all seen this situation. An exquisite, drop-dead, gorgeous woman walking hand-in-hand with a dude who is much, much less attractive than she is." Right? Kind of like a Beauty and the Beast type situation, but not as ugly. I know I definitely see it on a daily basis. Well, it turns out there's a reason for that. According to a new study, women are a lot happier when their boy toy is uglier than they are, which explains so much. This fucking writer loves this asinine fucking writing convention. For the study, researchers at Florida State University, do we really have to believe anything that's ever come out of Florida State University?
Fuck the Seminoles. Fuck the Seminoles.
Exactly. Florida State University evaluated the relationships of 113 newlywed 20-something couples in order to understand if respective attractiveness plays a role in overall happiness. And considering the fact that previous research suggests a combination of a hot wife and an ugly husband makes for a great marriage, this is pretty valid. So couples answered a survey. The results revealed that women who had attractive husbands were more likely to diet and constantly try to lose weight in order to look better and better at ad infinitum. This guy is a fucking pretentious douche. Which is not fun. Sure, following a healthy diet for the sake of health and wellness is great, but crash diets and eating dry salad until you're a dizzy mess? Horrible. I'm tired of reading this article. Let's just analyze it. I can't fucking deal anymore. These writers are shit. So, Justin, is this something you observed in reality on a daily basis, so much?
I think the only reason the author is observing it with so many so's in a row every day is because he's just a big King of Queens fan. That's the only explanation I can find.
Do those exist?
I mean, it has to. The show did really well. It did so well that in his new show, Kevin Can't Wait, they're killing off his wife to bring back Leah, how do you say her last name, Remini?
Yeah.
The one who escaped Scientology. So they're bringing her back to replace the woman who played his wife, and they're killing her off for season two. So that King of Queens had to have been that successful.
And it's like a sitcom?
Yeah.
That's gnarly. You can't kill off characters in sitcoms.
Well, they're doing it.
Like, her character's actually going
to
die.
I believe they killed her. I was reading an article. I believe they killed her off in the season one finale to bring back Leah Remini or whatever her name is. I can't say her last name.
Remini.
Just wanted to make sure that. Okay, go on.
So can we talk about the article now? Yeah, so I'm glad my minor joke sidetracked this. But this seems to me just an excuse to, lack of self-esteem and laziness on the part of women. Like, shouldn't you want to be with someone who encourages you to be better or inspires you to be better? And if you're doing it out of fear, doesn't that show your own self-hatred, that you're in perpetual fear that someone awesome is going to leave you? And then that's how you go about dieting, and that's how you go about exercising. You eat dry salad and you crash diet. Like, don't you, if you want to be healthy and look good, don't you then establish a lifestyle? I mean, there's only one way to go, really, and say, okay, you're completely wrong, because look at Tom Brady. And what I mean by that is they're both universally acclaimed as extremely good looking. I think Giselle looks like a horse, but I'm saying most people think they're both very good looking. And what do both of them do to stay that way. Well, they both eat in a specific way to stay that way. And they both work out in a specific way to stay that way.
I think Tom Brady, therefore you're wrong argument is probably a logical fallacy. I'm not entirely sure.
Appeal to Brady.
Reductio ad Brady. Yeah.
There was more meat to my argument than that.
Not according to Brady. He's not a big meat eater. But let's not focus so much on health issues here, because I think that was one example, but it's not entirely a health thing. Right?
Well, I was using that as an example. That I was saying that they're like, oh, you know, they're going to go about trying to be more attractive in an unhealthy way. And I'm saying that's the issue.
One of the things that I didn't really understand from this is how they determined, like, what the scale was of attractiveness, first of all. Like, this is a sort of a universal, perpetual question of, like, oh, she's a 7 and he's a 4, so they can't be together. And it's like, well, to whom and in what context? How are we judging this in terms of attractiveness?
I think they say...
Well, I think the danger of it is the women themselves think the men are less attractive. Because they're saying that when the women are with more attractive men, that they're all, like, insecure and, like, unhealthy about it. But when they're with men they find less attractive, they don't feel as threatened, so they can relax and, quote-unquote, be happier.
So it's entirely
about... That's
how
I interpret it.
So if it's entirely about self-perception, then it's entirely a self-esteem thing.
Each participant was ranked on desirability based on face and body attractiveness.
But so I'm wrong.
By whom?
By whom?
It doesn't say. Yeah.
But that means I interpret as the people who do the study are the ones who ranked them.
But
so basically,
yeah.
This old white dude ranked you on attractiveness or not, and based upon that, your happiness was determined.
I mean, that's not... The thing is like, I don't know, this finding doesn't surprise me. I don't think it's... Like, this finding doesn't surprise me based on the fact that, you know, self-esteem problems are really common, especially for women when it comes to their looks. There's a you know, large-scale self-esteem women or self-esteem problem for women often, you know, surrounding their looks. So it's like, this doesn't... But I love scientific studies that basically say, like, like, claim to have disproven a basic cause and effect relationship that has to be true. Like, effectively what they're saying is that, like, if you're a woman, you will be happier if you have an uglier husband. Like, that is a categorically false statement. It's like, you're going to be unhappy despite the attractive husband, not because of the attractive husband. Like, it's like... Attractive husband plus self-esteem problems, causes, you know, lack of satisfaction. Like,
yeah.
Attractive husband as such could never possibly make your life worse. That is just, like, so insane. Like, new study, food can sometimes lead to starvation. Like, it's just, it's a categorically incorrect statement. You can't say this.
Yeah, it's a great point. You're essentially saying money can't buy happiness. It doesn't, like, if you're unhappy and you have self-esteem issues and then you get an attractive partner, regardless of gender, you're not going to be happy.
Right, yeah.
Like, you can't just get rich and then buy happiness. It's the same concept.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, study in money doesn't increase quality of life. Well, I was like, well, no, that's categorically wrong.
Right. It's a fascinating point. I have one other sort of angle to this, which is how much of this is cultural. Obviously, what I'm about to say is anecdotal, so it's no FSU study. But, you know, there's this sort of almost like a trope in our culture when you talk to guys about the partner they're with. There's almost like this universal of like, yeah, she's way out of my league, or she's super attractive, and like, how'd she end up with this guy, to do the reverse, where it's almost just like a trope. So of course that's sort of like baked into a certain amount of our psyches, and thus wouldn't that also come out in this survey? That it's maybe just a cultural thing. I don't know.
I agree completely, because look at the magazine. It's Maxim. Who are they marketing it to?
Men.
The average guy.
Yeah.
So they're going to want to appeal to that psychology. And that's a psychology I understand completely. You know, I've been seeing this girl, Christine, and I have to catch myself sometimes where I'm thinking, like, you know, what, how did I get so lucky? Why is she with me? I don't deserve someone like this. But then I'm like, wait, no, don't say that out loud, because you do deserve her and you're equals. And that's why it works so well. But like I, like you said, it's so baked into us from the time that we're young as guys that, you know, oh, you know, women are such precious, special creatures and they're so much better than you. So you're lucky to have one who's awesome, that it just jumps to my mind as an instinct. And I have to really squash that down before I make myself look like I don't have self-esteem. Because sometimes my initial reaction to, or my initial thought to express my appreciation of her and her value, is to say that and belittle myself. But I don't really mean that. It's just that's, as you said, Daniel, that's what's been baked into me.
Right. And I don't know if that's universal among men, or if it's maybe a cultural thing, or even a Northeastern cultural thing, or I have no idea.
Hey.
But I get it a lot with people I meet all the time, where they're like, oh yeah, this is my wife. And then, you know, he'll say something like, yeah, I don't know how she ended up with a guy like me. And it's a lot of that all the fucking time.
Yeah.
So
it actually might be a Northeastern thing. That's an interesting, it's very similar to Boston culture, where like they're very angry and complaining about everything.
Yeah. So,
could it,
James?
Yeah.
Wait. Could it also be because, I don't know, this affects me a little bit, is I think we all culturally have a very strong idea of what makes a woman sexy, but it's a little more complicated what makes a man sexy, because women are more complicated in what they're attracted to.
Yeah.
So I think a guy who's maybe not that attractive, but has all sorts of other things, you know, he doesn't have six pack abs, et cetera, but he has all these other very attractive things going for him. He's confident, he's intelligent, blah, blah, blah. Like, can be extremely attractive just because of those traits. And he'll kind of be just thinking like, man, like, I don't really get it. I mean, what am I really offering here? But it's like, cause it's not, it's harder to see. It's just harder to grasp what makes a man attractive, perhaps.
To go back to the Kevin James point, I mean, humor is something that I think we really underplay in what makes guys attractive. I know that every girl that's ever been interested in me has thought I was funnier than I actually am. Not that I'm not funny, but like I say random, like non-funny shit and they laugh. And I'm like, why are you laughing right now? That wasn't funny. And they just think I'm really funny. And I think it speaks to a larger point, James. The point you're making is sort of the underappreciation of masculinity in our culture, to really understand what it is, to understand what women are looking for in it. And this goes to the whole, we talk about this all the time, the attack and the breakdown on masculinity, to try and say it's not worth it. It's not worthwhile.
Mm.
Yeah. Speaking of, I don't know. Fuck transitions. We need to talk about digital blackface in reaction GIFs, at least according to an article in Teen Vogue by Lauren Michelle Jackson. To reiterate what that phrase was, that was digital blackface. Yes. Okay. So the article starts out this way, and its core premise is baked here in the next couple sentences, and we're going to stop after its core premise to decide whether or not its core premise is meaningful. And whether or not it is, we'll go on, but I want to stop there first. So prepare yourselves. Are you ready? Adore or despise them, GIFs are integral to the social experience of the internet. Thanks to a range of buttons, apps, and keyboards saying, "It me," without words, is easier than ever. Point of order, I have no idea what the fuck that means. Moving on. But even a casual observer of GIFing, all of you people in the peanut gallery watching the GIFing going on, would notice that, as with much of online culture, black people appear at the center of it all, or images of black people at least. Pause. The entire article is based on this statement, so I want to make sure that we are all in agreement that even a casual observer of GIFing would notice that, as with much of online culture, black people appear at the center of it all. Justin?
Now, I initially wanted to reject this premise, but I went back through my text messages to see all the GIFs that I had used. And, you know, like I've got like I got a GIF here that says, "I think we're done here." And it's I can't remember the rapper. He starred in that movie with Bruce Willis, the 16 Blocks movie. And he was also in the movie where you don't forget to bring a towel, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Then I have one of The Rock. And, you know, I'm not exclusively
movie?
Using... What?
Moby?
Not Moby. Moby's white.
Oh.
I'll look him up in a second while you guys are talking. But and I also use
Orlando
white people.
Bloom?
You see what I'm talking. Yeah. Okay. Whatever. You're being fucking weird. Like, so you know, I am using gifts of black people, but I'm not using them in a disproportionate way. I mean, if anyway, I'm using them representationally. Like, what percentage of the American population is black? So I'm using black people gifts, but first of all, I'm not choosing them because they're black. But second of all, like, they're not the center. Like, the center of my gift usage is Dave Franco.
I think you're talking about Kesha. Okay, so
no one's gonna get your joke.
Okay, I'm hilarious. Yeah, the one thing I want to say about this premise is that it's maybe too specific before we move on, which is even a casual observer, you know, that black people appear at the center of online culture. I just think that black culture is overrepresented in general because it's attractive to a lot of young people across races. And I think that's an incredibly important point here that is going to really sort of disintegrate much of this article as we move forward.
The rapper is Mos Def.
I'm hilarious. Okay. If you've never heard the term before, this is from the article, digital blackface is used to describe various types of minstrel performance that become available in cyberspace. Blackface...
What? I'm sorry, we just had to take a pause on that one.
Yes. Blackface minstrelsy is a theatrical tradition dating back to the early 19th century in which performers blacken themselves up with costume and behaviors to act as black caricatures. Performances put society's most racist sensibilities on display and in turn fed them back to audiences to intensify these feelings and disperse them across cultures. Many of our most beloved entertainment genres owe at least part of themselves to this minstrel stage, including vaudeville, film, and cartoons. While
can they stop using minstrel stage? Because it makes me think of menstrual stage.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah.
Unlike other physical executions of blackface, she gives the example of Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder, and several others, that requires physical alternations and usually a change in demeanor, digital blackface is in some ways a more seamless transformation. Digital blackface uses the relative anonymity of online identity to embody blackness. Do we have to keep going? Okay. So the point of this article is that basically we're overusing black people in GIFs to sort of appropriate blackness to do something. I'm not even sure exactly what we are doing because we're appropriating blackness, but it's a bad thing.
Their entire argument is fucking flawed because of the examples they use. Did you see that they use an example from Community where Troy walks into the room of his darkest timeline and the room is on fire and everyone's in chaos and people use that as like a, oh shit, everything's fucked up reaction? That is a non... If you say non-gendered, what is it, non-raced? That is a non-raced reaction gif. Like, the fact that he's black is non-essential in that gif, just like the example I use of Mos Def, where he says, okay, we're done here, and then he throws a piece of paper down. Like, the fact that he's black is incidental in that gif. Same thing with the Troy one. The fact that he's black is incidental. The point is he came back from picking pizza up, and everything's crazy. That's the essential, not his race.
Yeah. So this is sort of, I don't know, the crux of it all. This is the paragraph that maybe we can deconstruct the most, which is, I'm not suggesting that white and non-black people refrain from ever circulating a black person's image for amusement or otherwise, except maybe lynching photos, Emmett Till's casket, and videos of cops killing us. Y'all can stop cycling those, thanks. There's no prescriptive or proscriptive step-by-step rulebook to follow. Nobody's coming to take gifts away. And this is where it gets fun. But no digital behavior exists in a de-racialized vacuum. We all need to be cognizant of what we share, how we share, and to what extent that sharing dramatizes pre-existing racial formulas inherited from real life. The internet isn't a fantasy, it's real life. So we need to be cognizant of our digital behavior because we can't live in a de-racialized vacuum, except that she said a sentence earlier, there's no prescriptive or proscriptive step-by-step rulebook to follow. So we need to be cognizant of it, but there's no way to actually know. We need to think about it, but there's no way of knowing whether or not we're right or wrong. Hooray for social justice!
Yeah, I know. That's social justice in a nutshell right there. But I just want to own this vacuum, like where I can just put on different settings and like take away, like let's do the deracialized setting and just go around and take away people's race. Or like the desexualized setting or degender, just go around and take away people's gender. I want to own this vacuum.
Billy Mays here for the deracialized vacuum. Have a tough black stain in your carpet? Get it out with the deracialized vacuum.
Oh my God. Yeah. We're all going to hell. Social justice hell.
But there won't be race when we go there because we have the vacuum.
I'm just laughing at this incredible... I laughed earlier at just this incredible gif of this... large black woman hurling a table.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And when people do that, it's not because she's black. It's because this fucking little, well, not little, but young girl picks up a table and throws it at someone. That's why you pick that gif.
Oh my God. That is just so incredible. I'm watching it over and over again. You have to, guys, you have to see this article just to see this gif. And then someone throws a full metal folding chair at her and she just catches it in one arm.
Yeah.
See?
It's some kind of brawl where people are throwing furniture at each other. They're having like a furniture party or something.
See this GIF like, and all the other articles from this week on themidside.com.
I don't.
And none of these GIFs, but none of these GIFs are really like racially like central. I mean, you already said that. They're just like they depict a certain emotion of some kind each. Like, and they're all being quoted not in a racial context whatsoever.
Is throwing a table an emotion?
Well, it's supposed to represent her fighting her anxiety.
Oh, which, okay.
And so she's like taking all these chairs and slings and arrows of outrageous fortune like a champ.
I mean, I know where I'm from. I know in Boston throwing a table is an emotion. Yes. There's like there's like
that
anger,
is one of the
annoyance,
emotions.
Frustration in throwing a table. Those are the top four emotions in Boston.
There's forlorn, ennui, and table thrown.
Yes, oh my God, the sheer torque required to hurl a whole table. Like, that is unbelievable.
James has a new love.
Who is this woman?
This is the deep irony of this article and all articles of this sort, which is that they have this premise of we can't live in a deracialized vacuum. Why? That's the Adam Carolla question that he always asks about this. Why? Why must we have a conversation about this? You, in fact, by having a conversation about it, are the one making it racialized. People are using these GIFs because they are amusing to them. They're using these GIFs because black culture has permeated throughout all of American culture and is in some way a dominant form of culture. That is literally the opposite of racism.
You haven't seen Get Out, Daniel. We're just all trying to appropriate black people, and they need to kill us and get out.
We don't live in a deracialized vacuum because these motherfuckers won't ever stop talking about race. And by these motherfuckers, I mean social justice idiots, not black people.
Glad you clarified.
Thank you. And by the way, literally the first thing I thought when reading this article is, this sounds like something that would have been written in a rhetorics program. And so I fucking right-clicked on the author's name, Lauren Michelle Jackson, and it turns out she's what? A PhD student in the Department of English Language and Literature at the University of Chicago. This is what we are producing in the humanities.
Oh, wow. That's good research. Can we all take a moment and applaud Daniel?
Thank you.
Good research. And midsiders out there, show Daniel's appreciation. That was good. I like that.
Fucking English.
Make sure you applaud. Like, even if you're driving, we need you to applaud right now. Just
move
start
your,
clapping
hands
your hands
from the wheel.
Work.
And I want you to all reply with fucking the clapping emoji. But you better all make that clapping emoji black when you do it.
Please tweet at us with a gif of a black person applauding.
Yeah, don't use that fucking one of Citizen Kane. That one's overused.
I do always use black Santa when I send a Santa emoji.
Yeah. So that's all I've got. English majors are ruining the world. That's all I've got.
They are, because they're also ruining the movies we're seeing. I'm going to talk about that a little bit right now in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Focused on James is going to review the Dark Tower in a second here. But first, I want to give a quick review of Atomic Blonde. Atomic Blonde is the new Charlize Theron movie. And Daniel, you expressed, I think we all tackled it, but you expressed major reticence over the thematic content of the movie from the trailer, correct?
Yeah, I said they were trying to make female action heroes into male action heroes, and I thought that's why the movie wasn't going to work. Because I don't think there's an inherent market for that. That's something to me that seems to be foisted upon us.
I would agree with that as an assessment of the movie, having now seen it. Ultimately, it's very weird how they demonize men in this movie. And in order to explain that, I have to explain the basic plot mechanics and spoil the two big twists at the end. But first, I just want to talk about stylistically. I did appreciate stylistically what this movie was trying to do. It's based on a comic book, and it's written by Kurt Johnstad, who co-wrote 300 and wrote 300 Rise of an Empire, and apparently worked for years with Zack Snyder. So you can kind of see the Snyder influence on this. But I would just say this is like, if you want to see why people are wrong when they critique Snyder, watch this, because this is like watching a bad, boring Snyder movie. First of all, execution-wise, I had trouble like staying awake in the beginning because it's very frenetic and all over the place and cutting back and forth, and I didn't really know what was going on. And then stylistically later on, you know, they have all these colors and everything and they work with saturation. But then when there's the big climactic fight, or one of the big climactic fights, where she's killing four guys to protect the package, which is this guy who has the list memorized. It's a stupid MacGuffin. They go very raw and very brutal. And it switches. It's very interesting the way it switches from almost romantic to naturalistic in that one scene. And what I'm talking about is, you know, when you watch Watchmen and it has this brutal violence, it's very clearly over the top with the stylized blood and the sound effects and the way it's shot. But here it's just very brutal for the sake of brutality. And this is definitely done intentionally, because what the movie is about, it's set in Berlin right before the wall comes down. And the list is a list of like spies and agents in, you know, the war, the Cold War. And if somebody has it or gets into the wrong hands, the Cold War could continue. Whereas they're saying the wall coming down in Berlin is when the Cold War supposedly ended, according to this movie. And in it, Charlize Theron is playing a British spy. And she's trying to go to Berlin and get the list and get out so that the wall will come down. But the whole time, there's a double agent working against her. And the double agent is not part of MI6, it's part of the Russian KGB. And you think the whole movie that James McAvoy is the Russian double agent. And there's this whole thing where, predictably, Charlize Theron ends up in a lesbian relationship. And James McAvoy, this is where the most anti-male thing comes in, because this ultimately makes no sense, right? James McAvoy kills her lesbian lover, who's a French spy. And Charlize Theron kills him at the end, and is like, you didn't have to kill her. And that's why we're supposed to believe he deserved to die, because he killed the woman. And when he's killing her, he's strangling her from behind. And as they're fighting, he like pushes her onto the bed. And it looks like he's like raping her from behind with the way the struggling is going on. So it's definitely intended to come across as like a rape scene. But as she's killing him and about to kill him, he's like, oh, so this is how you're going to make it look like you're not the double agent, by saying I'm the double agent? And earlier in the movie, about halfway through, I was like, no, she's the Russian double agent. So that's the first twist. I thought they weren't going to go through with that, because I was like, that's going to make her look like the villain. So they did that, and I'm like, oh, maybe she's actually going to be the villain, and this is a statement on feminism and everything. But then there's one more twist at the end. When she's with the Russians, and she's saying she's going to give them the list, so then they have the power, which obviously would restart the Cold War. The male who she's working for, the Russians, is like, you know, give me the list. You work for me. And she's like, no, I want to make it clear. I was never working for you. You were all working for me. She kills all of the Russians, and then she gets on a plane. And it turns out the whole time she's a triple agent, and she's actually an American spy.
Oh, boy.
But apparently only on some kind of feminist whim.
Well, no, the whole point is, like, America is the only country that supports feminism, I think. And, you know, liberation. Which it also doesn't make sense because she is a handler of the whole movie and John Goodman, who's telling her what to do. So ultimately, the whole movie is undercut. So she's a double agent, and James McAvoy, who's the British agent who she kills, who's supposed to be this anti-masculine, you know, this evil masculine figure, doesn't look that bad ultimately because she's a fucking triple agent. So maybe he's just trying, you know, he's talking about the game and how you can't tell what the truth is and who's lying. Well, maybe he's a victim more than he is evil for, you know, killing your lesbian girlfriend. Maybe he only killed her because he thought she was in on the game and everything. She was a French spy. And then, you know, how many fucking men do you kill because you're a triple agent? And we're just supposed to agree you're good at the end because you're American? Like, that felt like the payoff to this movie. It's like, oh, okay, everything's okay. She's American. She did it for America. So it's like this weird neocon ending. It's very bizarre. Ultimately, I give it like a 4, a 3.5, like only because they were trying to be stylistic and there were elements of like the Snyder use of music, but it's not worth seeing. Like, eh.
Liza saw it. She hated it. Thought it was retarded.
Did she say any of the same things I said?
Not really. I mean, her analysis of it was basically, it just ultimately made no sense. So,
well, right. I was pointing out why it made no sense. I think we're just, honestly, it's neocon. At the end, we're supposed to be like, oh yeah, she's American. Okay, it's cool.
Never attribute to neocon what you can attribute to incompetence.
Is that Crystal's razor? All right, James, you want to review The Dark Tower?
I certainly do. The Dark Tower is a movie about a book, but it is way better than the book. You should watch this movie. But seriously, it was really cool. I've read 70% of the Gunslinger book, which is the first of the Dark Tower series, and the book explains nothing. But I still kind of liked the book. This movie took all the things I loved about the book, put them in, and then took out all the shitty, cynical, opaque things about Stephen King and removes them. Stephen King is so cynical, and like, the hero in the Gunslinger book is kind of this unsophisticated brute, kind of. And they take all of that away. They do make him like kind of just a traditional cowboy, but like, oh yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but like, it's all I can say is it's less cynical than the books. And you just have to be prepared for it to be really weird. Everything makes sense, but you have to be prepared for like a lot of the details to never be explained. For example, my friend who I was watching it with was confused by the fact that there was magic, science fiction, and cowboys all in the same plot, but just accept it. Like, that's what it is. Just be cool with
so
that.
So better or worse than Cowboys and Aliens?
Oh, way better. But Cowboys and Aliens was okay. Like, but this was, I thought this was really good.
And I have a question about the runtime. Yeah. I heard the runtime's only around 90 minutes. Is that apparent when you're watching it? Does it feel short?
It does feel short, but it's fine. Like, it, I was actually really worried about
that. That's what
she
said.
Like, oh man, it's this epic novel, but like, they made it into a 90-minute movie. Like, what are they doing? But no, it's fine. Like, it's good that it's short. This is the sort of movie that, like, if we lived in an ideal culture, this would be normal. Yeah, don't take my high praises to say that this was like some kind of really deep movie that like we should all, that this, it reflects highly on the human experience and like teaches us something. Like, no, it's just really fucking cool. You know, I wish there were more movies like this where every, like, the very well plotted, and there's just enough mystery to give you that continuous feeling of like, whoa, this is such a weird world with all these things we don't understand. And I really like that sense of mystery, but you also know essentially what's going on with the motivations of the characters. Just prepare for the setting to not be explained and just focus on the motivation of the characters, and it makes sense.
Is it only based on the first book?
No, it's based on it changes a lot about the books too. It changes a lot of actual plot points, but all of them are for the better.
Daniel,
anyone want to guess the Rotten Tomatoes score?
A little 36.
Rotten Tomatoes game.
No.
You don't want to guess, James?
Oh, well, no, I know what the Rotten Tomatoes score is.
Oh, okay. I said 36.
It is lower. Half that. It's 18.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Worse than Batman versus Superman.
I mean, yeah, it's so... I don't know what they could have faulted the movie on. Like, what were they not liking?
Guns. There are guns in the movie. He shoots people with his heart.
Some of the quick reviews are like inconsistent, incoherent, often cheesy. A simple but boring mashup of Lord of the Rings and The Matrix. Forgettable. Loathsome. The kind of movie that occasionally rubs salt in your wounds by reminding you what could have been. Not watchable, just underwhelming. Rushing past the old stuff just to get to new stories. Sullen, superficially. A superficial slog. The phrase lump of coal comes to mind. Just reading some of the reviews.
These are just a bunch of people who are, like, just as cynical as Stephen King and were pissed off that they made this into, like, a movie with a heart.
Yeah.
All I know is nowadays I have an inverse interest in a movie based upon the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Yeah, a pretty good indication is that the fans gave it an okay score, 63, and the critics gave it a terrible one. I'm like, okay, this still might be good.
Yeah.
And it really was.
Out of curiosity, what did Atomic Blonde get?
Well, everyone had to like Atomic Blonde or else you're a sexist.
75%.
Yeah, look at that. Yeah, come on. Come on. All right. Let's talk about what's going to come out soon.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
LBJ is a biopic of the president starring Woody Harrelson. It also stars the guy who played Michael Weston in Burn Notice as JFK. Thoughts?
Hasn't he played JFK before, Jeffrey Donovan?
Maybe. I mean,
I swear to God, like in a show or something, he plays JFK.
I will look it up in IMDb, but I will say while we're talking about this, he is from Massachusetts, so.
So obviously.
Well, JFK was from Massachusetts.
We should get Joe Rogan to play JFK. He's from Massachusetts. Just, you know, anyone.
I love political movies. I love political TV shows. I'm not sure I can stomach the sort of glorification and making heroic a guy like Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was a fucking loathsome human being,
yeah.
Not just because his personality was loathsome and he was a racist, but also because the ideas he pushed have caused incredible harm to the country and to the people he purported to want to quote-unquote help. I doubt this movie will touch on any of this, or if it does, that would be more brave than I think this movie is going to be. But Lyndon Baines Johnson was pretty much an overt racist. Before he made it to the White House, he voted against... I mean, he was blatantly anti-civil rights, and so much so that he loathed Kennedy for his whatever. But, I mean, just a few choice statements... from Lyndon Baines Johnson, for instance, when he was talking about how you pass civil rights bills and whatnot. He says, I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. That's a fun quote. Then, of course, there's the infamous quote that Snopes says is uncorroborated, but... no one has actually come out to say that it's not a quote that he said, so this is Snopes being a little lefty, I think. But he says, essentially, about the Great Society nonsense programs he was having, I'll have those N-words voting Democratic for 200 years. So, what a...
He's like the Ellsworth Dewey of black people.
What a swell guy! Shouldn't we make a movie about this guy being a hero? Fuck this guy. Fuck LBJ, fuck everything he ever stood for and thought. He's a racist motherfucker who helped no one, as in fact crippled a whole generation of human beings by putting them on welfare. So go fuck yourself, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Go fuck yourself, Woody Harrelson. I will not be watching this movie. I'll be actively boycotting this bullshit.
Well, and he was only president because a drug addict president got shot.
They cast in this movie, I think they cast him as like the hero we got, not the hero we deserved. Like, oh, we really wanted JFK, but he's imperfect. And I'm sure they'll cast him as a little bit racist based on what I'm seeing here. Like, they're casting him, you know, he's taking a shit in front of people and, you know, all this, you know. And it's the idea is it's like, oh, well, he's rough around the edges, but he enacted John F. Kennedy's dream of us becoming a socialist country and going down the toilet just like everyone else.
Yeah. He's a fucking monster.
So that's a tackle, James?
That's a tackle for Lyndon Blowjob.
Tackle.
So, interestingly, I'm both impressed by your memory and you're incorrect. He played another Kennedy. He played Robert Kennedy in the movie J. Edgar in 2011.
That's right.
So Jeffrey Donovan might be the first person to play multiple Kennedy brothers.
He's our Kennedy guy.
Get the Kennedy guy. But there's a couple interesting things about what you said in your review, James. And, you know, this builds off of what Daniel was saying as well. The first is that, you know, the hero we need, not the hero we deserve. Yes, that's what you said.
Is that what I said?
That's
the Batman thing, because I draw a straight line between LBJ and Batman when I think of like Batman and who to compare him to as a president. I'm like, Batman's obviously LBJ. But the other thing is, isn't this concept, hasn't it already been done in the Churchill trailer with Gary Oldman, and it's done much better? Isn't it the same thing they were going for?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. And then finally, certainly my final thought on this trailer is, this played like a bad sketch to me. Like, these are like bad impersonations. That's how this came across. It's like, why are we doing a whole movie of like people trying to impersonate JFK and LBJ? And why did they all go by their initials? And should I not go by my initials anymore because of this? Tackle.
Second trailer.
Stratton is, I don't even fucking know. Does anyone know what this movie is about from the trailer? I have no clue.
There's firearms in it. I liked that.
Terrorism, inside plotting, London might die.
It looks really trite, but I'm totally going to see this on Netflix or something. Like, there's guns, so.
So what is that for you, James? A hug?
That is a, like, hug?
Hug?
You know the movie London Has Fallen?
Yeah.
This is like, London might fall?
I didn't even know London was in this movie. I could not figure, like, I can't remember anything about this movie except the guy kind of looks like, I can't remember the, oh yeah, Keith, no, fuck, Carl Urban. I almost called Keith Urban, Kyler, Carl Urban, Keith Urban. Yeah, the guy kind of looks like Carl Urban. Kind of looks like Carl Urban, who plays McCoy in the new Star Trek. And I was confused. I was like, is this Carl Urban? No, that's not Carl Urban. Is it, what? Who?
This is, unequivocally something I will not see that my wife will see 15 times.
Really?
She loves this kind of movie.
We're going to have to start getting her to just do like Fize's like 5-second reviews or something. Mm-hmm. All right, that's such a tackle.
Tackle.
I am tackling this as well because, like I said, I don't even know what it's about.
Tackle. Final trailer.
Death Wish is a remake of an old movie, and it's directed by Eli Roth and starring Bruce Willis. Now, if you need to hear any more to want to see this movie, let me explain. In the movie, Bruce Willis's house is broken into, his wife is killed, and his daughter is put in the hospital. So because the police in Chicago aren't doing a good enough job, he becomes a vigilante killer in a hoodie, making us wonder if this is an unofficial sequel to Unbreakable. And in the trailer, for one final thought, he seems to move beyond avenging his wife's death and daughter's attack because there's a little black boy he talks to about the ice cream man who's hurting him, and then he goes and kills the ice cream man. So he seems to become just a vigilante in this movie. I will go first, and I will say two things about this. In the end of the movie, his therapist is like, well, whatever you're doing, keep doing what you're doing. And he's like, yeah, I will. And I'm like, yeah, Bruce Willis, don't stop making action movies like this. I'll watch them always. Also, I would watch a series of movies ad infinitum of Bruce Willis versus Dean Norris. Can we just make that happen for the rest of their lives? Hug.
Hug! Locked in amazing battle.
Yeah, there is a lot to be said. Are we going to get into the cultural criticism of this at all?
Yeah, go ahead. Bring it up.
So, the progressive, quote-unquote, social justice faction of the internet is fucking ripshit over this movie. Critic Alan Zilberman, who is a known leftist, tweeted that Eli Roth's Death Wish remake is so nakedly fascist that alt-writers will have an erection before the trailer ends.
How is it fascist when one dude is doing this on his own?
Which is, by the way, if I was making the poster for this, I would put, like, in, you know, the stupid short out of context quotes, nakedly fascist on the poster.
Yeah.
And alt-right erection. Yeah.
Those sound like great alt-right rap song names.
That's right. Scott Mendelson, who's another lefty, said, fair or not, I can't think of a more tone-deaf idea in this political social environment than white filmmakers remaking Death Wish. White filmmakers remaking Death Wish? Does Death Wish, the original, star Charles Bronson, right? The whitiest white guy of all whiteness?
I think the problem is that Bruce Willis is killing criminals, and some of those criminals are black.
Are we going to pretend that there aren't black criminals now?
And he was hurting the black kid. Bruce Willis was doing it because the ice cream man who was black was hurting the black kid. Like, so if you save a black person from another black person and you kill a black person, you're still racist? Like,
well, clearly black on black crime is, you know, okay.
Well, that's the thing. It's set in Chicago. So would they have rather a black filmmaker remade this starring Donald Glover and he's going around killing black people? As a vigilante?
They'd want it if it would be nice. He was going around killing white people.
Oh.
Yeah. Be totally fine. Yes. Maybe it's the marketing. This is Chuck Wendig. Maybe it's the marketing, but it seems a strange time to give a high five to an older, angry white dude going vigilante with lots of guns. So, the left wing is fucking losing its mind, which is just shows you the horrible, horrible political climate we're in. Because this is a fucking awesome looking movie. It is a remake, and by that I have to be sort of, I will begrudgingly see it because it's a remake, but I am going to fucking see it. And this is the type of action movie that my wife and I can enjoy together. It's a good date night action movie. So, total hug. I will see anything with Bruce Willis and a firearm.
Hug!
Well, that's the thing I want to add on to what you're saying is, you know, the political climate has changed because this movie really just does look like a cross between Unbreakable and Die Hard. And these movies have existed and are beloved, and now all of a sudden we make a cross between those two and we hate it?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I forgot my least favorite / favorite tweet about this, which was, angry old white man becomes an armed vigilante against Chicago civilians. That's a dangerous method. Message. Is Death Wish alt-right fan fiction? That's a dangerous message. At Adam C. Best, go suck your own cock, you fucking idiot.
Don't do that, because if he can figure out how to do that, he'll make lots of money by teaching others. So don't suck your own cock, you fucking idiot. And to add to the remake thing you were saying, Midsider Katrina told me the original is actually awful. So this might be a time where a remake is good, because it takes a good idea and actually executes it well.
It may be awful by any standard at all. Except it was my grandfather's favorite movie.
No, okay, well, in that case, James.
Firearms, hug.
Hug!
And Bruce Willis.
Hug.
Hug!
All right, let's talk about some other ridiculous shit on the internet. We'll round out the episode in Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit. How would Harry Potter be different if it took place in the United States?
It would just be magic animals in their locations.
Yeah. How to be different in the United States? Dumbledore would be marching in a gay pride parade. I don't know.
See, I'm tempted to go the social justice route as well, to say like he would have to always stay with his Asian girlfriend the entire time and things like that, and like he'd have to like, you know, find other black magicians to fight with him and things like that, or wizards. I'm sorry, don't get mad at me, Harry Potter fans. But isn't England more social justice-y than America?
In certain ways, yes, and in certain ways, no. Yeah. I think we're sort of more flaming about it, to use a certain term. They might be more intellectually terrible than we are, but culturally, I think we're worse.
So our in-your-faceness has been been co-opted in a bad way.
Yes. Also, no castles to speak of in America, so Hogwarts itself would be very different.
Well, would it be one of the? Would it take place in Newport, Rhode Island, and it would be one of the mansions in Newport, or would it be like a elite New England boarding school, like Andover, Exeter,
of like a '70s office building with terrible wood paneling?
Interesting.
Oh my God, Daniel!
I don't like Harry Potter, so this question just pisses me off. So,
oh no, dude! I just realized like it would be like a Monticello style thing, and then you'd find out like the first headmaster was Benjamin Franklin, who was a wizard, of course.
He's right, and then Nick Cage would come in and try to steal the Declaration of Independence.
That would be a much better movie.
You know what they're kind of doing something like this with is in the movie the
Kingsman.
The Kingsman, yeah. They're having the Statesmen, which look really cool. They have all these American style like secret agent powers. So that looks like
it'll yeah,
be
it's
cool.
Interesting the way they're doing that. But I was actually going to ask you guys about that. Is the whole lasso thing come across as dated to you guys, or is that still Americana, the lasso, or have we moved beyond that?
Lassos are in right now. Fucking Wonder Woman.
Oh, okay.
I just like the idea of stylized superpowers, basically.
No, I love the concept. Yeah. I was just asking if in today's day and age that actually represents America, or is that an old school archaic idea of America? The cowboy with the lasso and everything.
Yeah, I would like a more updated idea of what it means to be American, which includes something like, you know, technology-oriented or Silicon Valley, but, you know, that's cool. Lassos are still cool.
What if we just made the chaps assless?
That sounds like what would go on in Dumbledore's office if Harry Potter were American.
What the fuck, Harry? There'd be no more bloody hell, Harry. Yeah.
Would Harry be more or less of a pushover if it were American? And would Hermione be more or less feminine if it were American?
I don't know, but I just thought that he would not be Harry Potter. He'd be Hank Potter. Yeah.
All right. Next Reddit, and this is a loaded Reddit. My reason for picking it is loaded. What shows are just as good, if not better, than The Office? And the reason I included this, and this is why it's loaded, is my answer is many, many, many shows are better than The Office. And that's what I want to ask you guys has The Office become more beloved? It just seems like there's this fetishization or romanticization of The Office. Like, it's this amazing show, and it's this amazingly funny show. And I tapped out in The Office after, like, three seasons when they turned it into a workplace relationship comedy. I was like, this is a waste of my time.
I tapped out way sooner than that. My response to this question was much like yours, which is that the list of shows that are not as good as The Office would be much, much shorter, because The Office fucking blows. Hot take, aww. The Office is terrible.
Wow, you said hot take.
I think The Office is funny, but it's just, I find The Office very dark in a certain way.
It's all the fluorescent lighting.
Here's what I like to say. I like to say that Always Sunny in Philadelphia has a much more positive view of man than The Office
does. That's terrifying. Yikes. Because I can't watch that show because I hate the fucking people on it.
Yikes.
Always Sunny? Yes. Well, here's the thing about Always Sunny, is that Always Sunny portrays people who are much worse than the people in The Office, obviously. But in Always Sunny, you're laughing at how terrible they are. And so by negation, it's like it has a positive view of man, because it's saying, like... And if you look at the side, all the side characters in Always Sunny, they're, like, completely rational people who are just victimized by the assholery of the gang. And then, but then they eventually, the good people who are side characters eventually win out. So, like, it actually portrays a very positive view of man in my regard. Although I don't blame anyone who just finds the depravity of that show unbearable and can't watch it. But The Office makes it sound like that boredom and depravity is just normal. Like, oh, that's just how people are.
Well, that's where I have to push back on you. And Daniel, you can follow up on what I'm about to say in a second. That's where I have to push back on you, James. I get the argument. I've heard it before, and I think Daniel presented it to me about you're laughing at the people on It's Always Sunny. But to me, it's the same thing as, like, Wedding Crashers. I don't think people are laughing at those characters. I think they're laughing with them. And they're saying, ha-ha, that's what life is like. Isn't that funny? Just like with Wedding Crashers, where they're like, we're going to put the rules the Wedding Crashers use for relationships up on our walls as if there's something to live up to. I just don't agree that people are laughing at them. I don't.
Yeah.
That's a good argument for Wedding Crashers. I think people are laughing with Wedding Crashers. I think you're supposed to laugh at the Always Sunny gang, the way they set it up. That doesn't mean people won't laugh with, but it's set up to laugh at, I think.
I don't, so I went through this McKenzie phase recently where I was rewatching some older shows that I didn't partake in when they were on television, like Parks and Rec and 30 Rock, both of which I enjoyed immensely, and I could not make it through like 5 episodes of The Office. I found it atrocious. I found it tedious. I found it fucking hitting me over the head with idiocy. Like, I just couldn't deal with it. I did not find the writing clever at all. So my list of shows that is better than The Office is almost all of them.
Any comments on It's Always Sunny?
I don't really watch it. I've seen a couple episodes. To me, it's just sort of this general bizarre nature of it that I can't get over. I don't know. It's Danny DeVito looking like a homeless man that I just can't deal with.
It's one of the funnier parts of the show, but... Last Reddit. What did your parents do that taught you what not to do?
Smoke. Probably the main one.
How so? How did it teach you not to do it?
It was a real-life demonstration of how terrible smoking is. You know, it was never one of these things where... I don't know how this works from a child psychology perspective, but there were things where it was just like, I clearly get that this thing is terrible. How do you not get that this thing is terrible? Like, it makes your clothes smell bad, it's expensive, and it gives you lung cancer. It's fucking awful. Why are you doing it? Like, I'm 6. How do you not understand this? I mean, there are other things, but that's, I mean, one that stands out to me most is I was adamantly anti-smoking from the time I could probably speak. So.
James?
This one's hard because there's just a lot of things. And I'm also afraid that my parents will end up listening to this.
Well, let me use that as a springboard.
They'll have to know at some point.
Let me use that as a springboard to explain that I have learned how not to show appreciation and how to not show you value someone because my parents will never listen to this show or anything else I do.
That's right. Hooray, Justin's parents.
Yeah, shit.
So go ahead. Now, this will make your parents feel better if they hear this.
Yeah, right. I mean, and my parents, you know, whether or not they listen to this, they do listen to my podcast that I do on my own. So, like, yeah, they definitely do, do try to appreciate, you know, me and what I do. But something that I've always disagreed is just sort of general conservatism. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just very much not what I do. Like, or to use Jordan Peterson's words, I'm very high in openness, where they're very high in orderliness. So I always try to, I just always want to do something new experience, And, you know, I don't like to stick to the routine that I know works. I like to do something new. So that's how I do it.
That's how I do. Sweet.
All right. Let's put a feather on this episode, a bow, a cap, whatever metaphor for ending it. Don't start the whispering thing again. Don't.
The whispering thing didn't get rave reviews?
No, not from me.
Everyone was texting me saying, James, as a mid-sider, I love the whispering. I listened to 2 hours of this show just to get to the part where you whisper, you repeat random meaningless parts of what Justin is saying as though they're significant.
That's right. Could you whisper the whole show, James? That'd be great.
No, I'm just going to whisper like non-essential words. Only the non-essential
words.
Like
the worst hype man in rap ever. And midsiders, if you're all texting James about things in the show, you're all fired as midsiders.
Texting.
All right, Daniel, what did you learn this episode?
Learned that apparently Fiza is only with me because I'm fucking hideous.
Really helps her self-esteem.
Yeah.
James?
I learned again and again and again how terrible studies in sociology are, where, you know, we're going to publish this study because it's so edgy and we're going to appear to, like, you know, disprove something that could not possibly be disproven.
That's right. Justin, what did you learn?
That's right.
Interestingly, I'm also going to pinpoint that same story, which, by the way, when I originally shared it in the thread and asked if we should use it, James was like, for what reason? Maybe I was right. But no, I just, you know, looked at and found and identified the source of, like, random thoughts I have sometimes. And it's interesting to see that sometimes it's beyond the way you were raised and your family and your social situation, that it's a broader cultural force that you don't even realize is infecting your brain.
Well, you people out there in Midside Landia, what did you learn? We want to know what stamped your passport this week on this wild trip that is the Midside. Tell us on
what infected your brain.
The social medias. We have things like Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and then other things all at the Midside.
We're now on Wiggler indeed too.
Wiggler,
where you can send black and white photos with emojis that last for 2 seconds.
We're not on that because I don't know what that is.
I made that
excellent.
I just thought that would be a good social media.
I think it would be. Regardless of what your social media
sounds like, black and white face
of choice is, send us a reaction gif to what you thought of this episode.
Sounds like mulatto face.
If you want to listen to past episodes of this enlightening podcast, visit themidside.com/podcast, where you can get all of them, or you can go to iTunes or Google Play and subscribe so you can get this podcast delivered to you as soon as it's published. While you're there at iTunes, why don't you give us a little 5-star review? Helps.
Yeah.
Helps us move up the rankings. We're going to pass Welcome to Night Vale, those fuckers. I bet they like social justice crap. I mean, I don't really know them. I don't even know what the show is about, but I'm sure it's terrible. Just kidding. It's probably fine. I have no idea. Did anybody listen to it? Do you know what it is?
I should have.
I think it's like a mystery show or some shit. Let me look it up.
Really? Okay. Well, if you like that crap, you might as well give us a 5-star review and tell us why we are awesome and or terrible, as long as it's 5 stars. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us and their little libertarian network. We love our libertarian friends, even though we disagree on many things. It's all right. It's all right. We're a big tent here at the Midside. Not too big, but big enough. And then finally, Patreon. Oh, glorious.
Wait, I think this is an actual Patreon town. Twice monthly community updates for the small desert town of Night Vale, featuring local weather news announcements from the sheriff's secret police, mysterious lights in the night sky, no, dark-headed figures.
They have a secret police?
I knew you were going down a route of looking like an idiot the moment you said this might be a real town.
With unknowable powers and cultural events, turn on your radio and hide. Never listened before? It's an ongoing radio show. Start with the current episode and you'll catch on in no time. Or go right at episode 1 if you want to binge listen. Now we're promoting this show on our show.
Yeah, we're giving them, like, they are trumping us right now because we're just giving them tons of free
I just internalized our oppression.
They appropriated our midsideness for their nature.
That's right. Are welcome to.
Anyway, forget those guys and go to patreon.com/themidside where you can choose to help us monetarily, that is, with money, if you have it,
that's
to give,
right,
by choosing to give us money every time we produce a piece of content. So let's say we don't produce content for 2 weeks, you don't give us anything. But every time we put out a podcast, you throw in $1, $2, $5, $50, whatever you can afford. It all helps us keep the lights on. We are light addicts here. Let me tell you, and
so many lives.
But if you can't afford that, and you can't give us an iTunes rating because you have no fingers, and you can't, well, then the thing you can do is tell a friend. Telling a friend is the number one way that your friends know about us, and we want your friends to know about us because we need to grow this audience. These guys, James and Justin, going to this podcasting masterclass to become master casters. This is not all for naught. We want to do it for more people like you. We want to reach the entire world of Midsiders, which we believe is probably in the tens of people. So please, tell your friends about us and help us grow this great adventure and experiment we call Welcome to the Midside. Until next time, we love you. See you later.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
I would just like to point out that there is a Night Vale in Baja California, Mexico, and weird shit happens in Mexico, so that podcast might not be fictional.